It is now my great pleasure to have the opportunity to introduce our speaker for today, Mr. Otto Dreger, who, along with his wife Florence, is one of the founders of the Circles of Support and Accountability for Southern Saskatchewan. He is a retired University of Regina professor who was instrumental in the development of the Human Justice Degree Program at the University of Regina. Mr. Dreger.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and be together with you and sharing various issues and singing and so forth. You've all heard a lot about COSAs because there have been many speakers here before. So what I will do today is give you a profile of a person. And I have received permission from him to share anytime I want to. But I also checked with him this morning just to make sure that he was fine with me sharing about his profile with you here this morning. And he said there's no problem at all with that. So that's what I will do. Now, I also have notes that I will provide. I will have copies of them downstairs. So, but all of these, pretty well all of these particular points in my notes will be covered by the story, by the profile. And we also have a pamphlet, and we'll also make those available downstairs for you. This person, we'll call him Don, that isn't his real name, has spent 34 years in prison. He is now 56 years old. He has been involved in serious violent and sexual offenses, the last one of which yielded a lot of years in prison because he very severely injured the person. He also had a sexual whom he raped. He has been out for a couple of for some time now, and has had a circle since he came to Regina a couple of years ago. He was first in the halfway house here in the Oscana Center, and then now is in the community. Don was in, particularly in the penitentiary in Prince Albert for many years. And when he got out on occasion, one time he was married and he settled down, but then he started connecting up with his family, and his family was not a positive influence on him. And his last offense was against a family member, a cousin, and that alienated him entirely from the family. So he now has no contacts with his family at all. They want nothing to do with him, which was very typical of persons who have spent a lot of time in prison, particularly with sex offenses. So that, generally speaking, if a person wants to turn their life around, it's important to have family support. In addition, because he's been so many years in prison, he has no friends that are out in the community. The only friends he has are people that have also been in prison. So that when a person wants to change their life around, to do that without any friends that have not had the same kind of a philosophic orientation that he did or approach to life is very difficult. Actually, on that particular point, I've just drafted a bit of an article, and I'm checking it with a number of people that have been in prison. And they have a lifestyle before they go into prison, which tends to be violence, many of them, and particularly with violent and sexual offenders. Then when they get into prison, they have an entirely different lifestyle, because everything is ordered. They cannot do any thinking for themselves. All decisions are made for them, which is a fantastic change of lifestyle. If you sort of think about that kind of a change in lifestyle for yourself. Then thirdly, when they come out, and if they want to go straight, then that's again an entirely third kind of a lifestyle change. So you go from a life of actually in many instances irresponsibility and violence and so forth, to a lifestyle of rigidity in the institution. And then you go out in the community and you want to go normal, quote. And I know one of the guys came out, he said, I don't know what's normal. Because he had also been in prison for 20, 25 years. So when he would go to have coffee at Tim Hortons, he would say to our circle, I think she's coming on to me. When you say, why are you saying that? Well, she's pleasant and she's talking to me. We said, that's normal. That's what's expected of a person that works in a place like that. Whereas he interpreted that as her coming on to him. So, three different kinds of lifestyles. Don, when he was still in prison in Prince Albert, he was involved with a certain program which was called Person to Person. What that program is a person from the community goes and visits the long-term offenders on a one-to-one basis. And that's once a week. And we have volunteers in the north of Saskatchewan that come to the prison. And there's usually about 20 or 30 guys that have visitors like that. He said that assisted him, first of all, to connect up on a basis of interpersonal relationship. Then when he came to Asgana Center and the opportunity came to have a circle, he was very interested because during that period of time in prison, he said he had a lot of time to reflect, and then with the person-to-person program, it gave him the opportunity really to sort of rethink his life. And he changed course. And he wanted to, when he came out, live a law-abiding life. So when we developed the circle, he was still in a halfway house. And when we have circles, we usually have both men and women on the circle. And the reason is that particularly persons who have offended sexually tend to see women as sex objects. And in order to have a circle for a person, women need to be on the circle so that the person, the core member, as we call him, learns to relate to women as people, not as sex objects. And to have an interpersonal dynamic with women as well as with men. Now, we of course make very sure that if the person has offended against young women, that we wouldn't have young women on his circle. If he has offended against children, then a young woman on that circle would no problem. In Don's particular case, he did not offend against children. He offended against young women, so we had older women on his circle. Then when he came out, a couple of things that we don't even think about, and actually Don lives with us right at the present time. He said, after the first night, he said, you know, that is the first time I have slept in a bed that is not an institutional bed, which is these narrow sort of beds. In 24 years, his last sentence was 24 years. He said, it's the first time I've had a bath in a bathtub. Because in the prisons you have showers, and showers are fine. But to have a bath, and sort of relax in a bath, is one of the kind of things we never sort of think about. And so those are the kind of things that even all of the various kinds of things that have happened have changed in 24 years. If you think back 24 years, some of you can't think that far that back because some of you might not be that old. But if you think back 24 years, in terms of iPhones, in terms of all the various kinds of gadgets that we have now, the way our lifestyle has changed in 24 years, there's a lot of adjustments to make. And that is what Don found as well. One of the things that he said, has said, is that the happiest times of his life were that short period of time when he was married to his spouse. And before he then started again slipping back. And now that he is out, that he is sort of shifting his life around. Don is also now graduated from being in a circle, because he has become much more stable in his new lifestyle. And actually, Don now actually volunteers. He is not a volunteer in the full sense of the word, in terms of being a volunteer on a circle, but he will attend circles as an adjunct member of the circle. And it is very, very good to have him in circles of that kind. We have one person who is not in the city. He is lives in the community, in the rural area, and he molested children. Many men who molest children are not really pedophiles. Some of them are, if they have a mental handicap, they relate to children, not to adults. And as their sexual urges are developed, they relate to children. And those are persons who molest children, but are not basically pedophiles. The person that I'm referring to now is basically a pedophile, because he is attracted to children and cannot help himself. So in his circle, what we try to do is assist him to control his urges in relationship to children, and not to put himself into vulnerable positions where he will be in a situation where children are a temptation for him. Now, Don, the guy that comes to that circle, and actually we will be going to that circle this afternoon out in the country, is very helpful, because when we have discussions with this other person who's a core member, he will say, well, I like children, but there's no way I'm going to get back into that. We say, don't even consider having a relationship with children, even though you like children, because you can slide back so soon, so easily. And Don is very helpful in that, because Don has had other kind of experiences, and he says to this rural person's core member, you know, don't allow yourself any temptations of that kind, because you don't want to go back to prison. And you will, even if you don't molest a child, but if you find, if the police or anyone in the community sees that you have had interrelationships with children, they can immediately report that and say he is again connecting up, or he is again nurturing a relationship with children, and he'll be back in prison just right like that. Now, for us to say that is one thing, but for Don to say that makes it so much more profound, and it makes it, and it, the impact is so much stronger. So we find that having that aspect of Don assist us in our circles across southern Saskatchewan is very, very important. So we find that a person that has been in prison for 34 of his 57 years, or 56 years of life, having changed for the third time in a lifestyle, that is where the circle can be very helpful. Because when his family rejects him, he has no friends in the community, and nobody wants him to live in their area because everybody is afraid, then an artificial group of people who are prepared to, quote, be friends with him is very, very important to assist him to shift back into a positive lifestyle in the community. That is what circles are all about. And what circles then we can do is to say, okay, what's normal? We can sort of assist a person on that. What are the things that assist you or make you slide back into patterns of criminal behavior or breaches? Then the circle can assist that person to withstand those kind of temptations or those kind of issues. Like we have some people that, actually we have had over 30 persons in southern Saskatchewan with whom we have worked in circles. We have, at the present time, we have 14 circles going. But over this period of time, we've had 30. One of those 30 core members has reoffended violently and sexually out of the 30. The others have been assisted not to reoffend violently or sexually. Now, some of them have had breaches of their probation or their parole and have gone back into prison for a short period of time because of that, but not because of violent or sexual offending. Now, when a person is under parole or under supervision on 810, which would be probation supervision, they have certain criteria that they have to follow. And sometimes they can be onerous because you and I can do many of the things that a person on parole or probation cannot do, is not allowed to do. And to assist a person to accept the fact that under these circumstances you cannot do those things is very important. Because if the person gets negative about these things, it makes it more possible that he will sort of move back into reoffending. Or to get to breach and be back into prison. So there's that dynamic that there's always is present in the circles. We had a particular project that was funded by the National Crime Prevention Council for 5 years. That ended in September. They provided additional funding so that the 15 or 16 sites across the country where we have circles were funded in an adequate way so that one could really provide the services and do a good job. You've had Amanda here so that she was our staff person. We had to suggest to her whether she would be prepared to be on a part-time basis, and she, of course, being a young person, wasn't able to do that, so she is not in our employ anymore. My wife, Florence, is doing it on a part-time basis, 2 days a week, even though she spends more than that by the time. But she's doing that on an interim basis till we can get funding more established more adequately. So circles across the country, the sites where there are circles, we have about 150 circles that are happening across the country. And many of the sites are also having very difficult financial times. The federal government, in addition to the project money, provided some money on an ongoing basis for the services. Here in Regina, we were getting $25,000 a year from the federal government. The federal government has said, as of March the 31st, there will be no money available for circles, not just in Regina, but across the country. And that is one of the reasons why, and with the project ending, that is why we're in dire straits on that. But we're sort of moving towards finding at least enough funding that we can go on a part-time basis. We're not going to be ending our services. Anyway, that is basically how we operate. It's a friendship circle, not surveillance, not control. Those are appropriate responsibilities of the police and of probation and parole. But ours is a friendship base, although we interrelate, of course, a lot with police and with the support services like probation and parole. But we are a friendship group, and that is a very important one. Because when I was reading you the principles of your organization here, I'm not passing by, relating, and the principles of respect for everyone. Those are the principles of COSA. And we very much appreciate the opportunity to have sharing with you and the support you provide through Helen being involved in our organization as well as your representative. So we find that we have other organizations that are also providing support and representation, which is a very important community base for our service. I think I'll quit there if there are questions.
Thank you again very much, Professor Dreger. I know there are questions, and if you could stay for a few minutes and answer questions, it would be just terrific.
Hi, Weeb over here in the corner here. I have a question. Just, we were talking about circles of support with a couple of friends, and they were asking about the John Howard Society and if they provide the same support or is it different or at different places. And then my second question is, how does one become a graduate of a circle? Like, I thought my impression was in the past was that it was an ongoing.
Yeah.
And so when do those end?
Very important questions. John Howard Society is a very important organization that provides a lot of practical services to people when they come out. Also do advocacy with governments and so forth. I would suggest that they are a parallel kind of a collaborative organization, but they do not provide circles in the way that we do, in an intensive kind of a way. But we intercommunicate a great deal and see ourselves as being collaborative. With regard to your second question, see, what was that again?
How does one become a graduate?
Oh, a graduate. Oh, yes. Okay. Well, after a person has been stabilized for a period of time and does not really need a circle anymore, because very many guys will develop other support groups, friends, employment, and so forth. And at a certain stage, may feel, well, I think it's a time that I don't really need that kind of a circle anymore. Now, that is a positive kind of a way, and some people will graduate that way, which is, Don was one of them. There are many men, particularly where there's been a negative influence on by the family, and persons who have a problem with mental capacity, where we have got some circles that have been going since we started for 15 years, and some circles end because of the person not really continuing on with wanting to be in a covenant relationship with other people. And so there are negative reasons why people would also not continue with the circle. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Thank you very much. I'm right here.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Okay. I have two questions. One is, what inspired you to start these circles for sex offenders, as opposed to other kinds of circles of support for other people coming out of jail.
Okay, I'll answer that one, then you can ask the other question after that. Yeah. So sex offenders are the most, there's most negative attitude in society towards sex offenders and violent offenders. And we, across the country, felt that circles needed to start with the most serious situations. Circles would be good for everybody. But if we start with everybody, then usually the most serious ones don't get any service, because it's so much easier to work with guys that are not in such a serious situation. So the priority has been to focus on the most vulnerable, the most alienated, and the ones that are most hated in community. Mm-hmm. That is why this happened. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Another question that I have is, it seems to me that socioeconomic status of the people in the circle is probably considerably different from the socioeconomic status of
That's
a person
right.
coming
yeah.
out of prison, but also probably before that person was in prison as
yeah.
well. They may very well have had fairly low socioeconomic status.
Yeah.
And various things I've read about social groups and organizations and friendships, that these rarely cross class barriers, socioeconomic
yeah.
Barriers. So could you just address that for a minute?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a very, very important issue, and that is a very difficult one. The situation, as you describe it, is exactly what happens. But we try to have as wide a range of people in volunteers as are prepared to volunteer, although their socioeconomic situation is generally very different. We try to be aware of that, but we cannot resolve that. I know one person who was in that kind of a situation. He was First Nations, or is First Nations. And he said, and I was on his circle, and he said, "Wow, if I told my friends that I was connecting up with a professor, that'll blow their mind." So those are the kind of barriers one has to sort of try to overcome. And one can only do that partially. And that is why it is also important to encourage people to connect up with people in their own socioeconomic bracket. Or we have some guys that are younger to relate to old codgers like me, you know. Is another whole kind of a situation. So it's a very important question, and there's not a very good solution to it. Other than the fact that, like, for instance, I would imagine in your group here, you have a variation. In most faith communities, that situation is addressed, to some extent. I'm Mennonite, and in our faith community, we have people who are unemployed, who are tradespeople, who are laborers, and who are professionals. And if one really focuses on humanity, which is what your principles also identify, then one tries to address those things in those ways. Yeah.
Thank you, Otto. I'm Bruno. I was going to ask it. It's not really an interesting question, but I thought I may ask it. Is there a correlation between rehabilitation of...
Between what?
Rehabilitation from the person, the core person, and this person's ability to cook.
And his what?
This person's ability to cook for himself.
Pardon?
Cook a meal for himself.
Cooking. Cooking?
I'm asking you.
I'm not sure I understand this question.
So my question is this person's ability to recover, this person's ability has a better chance to recover if the persons know how to cook?
If they know how to cook. Yes, some guys, yeah. Actually, though, in the halfway house here in Oscana, for instance, they address that kind of a thing because there they have to cook for themselves. It's not a dining. They don't all eat together, and so the learning of taking care of practical things, not only of cooking, but buying their groceries and other things, is part of that shifting into the society, which is an important point. Yeah. And it's also one of the things where in the shifts in lifestyles, and that's a very important part of it. It so happens that Don, the person I was just talking about, worked in the kitchen in the penitentiary, and he was also very interested in cooking. So he took cooking courses. So that actually, he is we call him a chef, but he says no, I'm not a chef. He says I'm a cook, and he does very well. I mean, but that is an important point. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Ingrid.
Yes.
Hi. I just wondered, first of all, I'd just like to say I think you're doing amazing work. I don't know that I would have the courage to do that. But I wondered about other countries and other models. Like, I often think that some of the Nordic countries often have, you know, these very thorough ways of rehabilitating people in a non... military way, dictatorial way.
Yeah.
Yes, and I just wondered if there are models elsewhere. And just to say, I like Bruno's idea, because I think if people feel self-sufficient, that they can do things, I think that really helps strengthen the inner being.
Khosas are part of the whole movement of restorative justice. And there are three major areas in restorative justice, or four more major areas in restorative justice. One of it is the faith communities have had a very important role in developing reconciliation and healing and respect of persons. First Nations traditions have had a very important contribution to this whole area. Actually, the whole rehabilitation movement after the Second World War to the present that have moved into, quote, treatment and rehabilitation and practical courses in prisons and so forth is a third very important area. And a fourth one, which people generally don't acknowledge too much, even in the restorative justice initiatives, is victimology as part of criminology. Because it was in the victimology research at universities, not just in Canada, but internationally, where they identified the nature of victims, the issue of the interrelationship between victims and offenders, and also actually that a very high proportion of offenders are also victims, so that you get into that whole dynamic. Now, circles of support and accountability started in Canada, actually in Hamilton, and have moved across the country, and there's been the research and so forth done on it. That has been picked up by some of the states in the United States. That has been picked up very strongly in the United Kingdom and in some of the countries in continental Europe as well. So that it is a movement that has started here, and to me it's ironic, and there the governments are really providing the funding, stable funding, in order to really move it forward. It's ironic that in Canada, where we started with circles, that our funding is being withdrawn.
Well, that was part of my question. Your funding, you said that your federal funding was being cut. Did you get provincial funding as well? And also, how do you persuade these people as when they leave the prisons to get involved in a circle, the most difficult offenders?
And the last question, can you repeat that again?
Are they aware of these circles and that they should be involved?
Yes, very, very much so. Starting with your last question, we have a very strong interrelationship with penitentiaries, and particularly with chaplaincy services and with parole in the institutions. That's where we get a lot of referrals, because they are very strongly supportive of this whole thing. The provincial government is very strongly supportive, both in terms of the bureaucracy as well as the politicians. We've talked to politicians as well. Now, we have requested funding provincially for the last number of years already, and one of the ways on an interim basis in which they do provide some funding is that if a person is on probation, which is a provincial matter, they will provide us with $250 a month for each person that's on a circle. And we have not too many, because Most of them are on parole, but the ones that are on probation, we get that kind of thing, and not just in Saskatchewan, in Regina, but also in Saskatoon and PA, because we made the negotiations. Now, we have a proposal in for base funding from the year to year on a provincial basis. And as I say, there's a lot of support, but you never know in whether it's going to actually make it into the budget. And with the oil situation the way it is, I suspect that this year we won't. But it's an ongoing thing that we're hoping for in the long run. And I think on the long run we'll get some funding from the province as well. In the federal government, we have a strong communication with the other parties, both the Liberal and the NDP, and with an indication that should there be shifts in government, that persons like Ralph Goodale are fully aware of COSAs and this whole thing, and Wayne Easter in the East, who was also very involved in the justice portfolio federally, so that we try to nurture as many ways in which we can get support. We've also had discussions with the city of Regina, and the police chief is very supportive. Actually, he invites us for a lunch meeting every year in order to have discussions about this. And on our advisory committee, or our steering committee as we call it, we have representation from the police and from probation and parole and the federal government to have a discussions about how to move this forward. So we say it's important to collaborate, but it's important not to be captured. And so in the beginning, in the early 2001 and 2 when we started, some of them, the police would say, it's good to have that additional arm of control in the community. We say, well, that's not our role. Our role is a friendship thing. And parole or probation would say, it's nice to have that additional surveillance. We say, that's not our role. That's your role. Our role is the friendship context and the respect of human beings as equal, which is our contribution. And now that doesn't come up that much because they recognize the importance of our kind of role, which is something they can't do, and they do things that we can't do. Does that answer your question? Excuse me? That's right, yeah. Yeah, that's the whole restorative justice base, yeah.
Professor Dreger, I've got a question in terms of if you can tell us what sort of number of people would you be dealing with that were on parole versus those who had been gated? So in other words, are you often in a situation where people are concurrently dealing with you and the parole board, or are they in a situation where they have been gated offenders?
Gated?
Have been held to at warrant expiry.
Yeah. We have a fairly high percentage that are warrant expiry. But as you know, with warrant expiry, they can get an 810. An 810 is, if some of you may not know that, the police can take it forward to the judge saying, this person should have supervision on an ongoing basis, even after warrant expiry, even after the sentence is over. And we have a number of 810s, not too many. At the present time, I think we have 2 out of 14. We have, at the present time, out of the 13 that we have on, there are 2 that are on 810s or on probation. We have 5 or 6 that are under parole supervision, and the others basically are on a community basis, and some of them have long-term offender status, LTSOs, if you know what that is. So that's why we say that we should get. That's why we think it's legitimate for us to suggest funding from the municipality, because a lot of them are basically community. also from the federal and from the provincial. And so that's the basis. Yeah.
Given the level of interest, I'm sure we could go on for quite some time this morning, but I'm hoping that Professor Dreger, you can stick around for a little while afterwards, and I'm sure that there'll be a lively discussion over coffee. I'd like to have the opportunity to thank you very much for attending, and given a very lively presentation.
Thank you.